You're listening to Food Talk FPL on 590 The Fan KFNN and KFNF.com. Now, let's go back to David Craig.
Okay, you need to check out the Blowpoke at BLOPOKE.com. I know I'll be using mine. Get a big fire going in the fireplace during the Super Bowl game tomorrow. All right, on Food Talk STL, we have another Scott joining us now. Hey there, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you so much for giving me a call. I appreciate it.
All right, happy to have you on the show. This is Scott Haas, and you have a book out called Back of the House, The Secret Life of a Restaurant, and you were kind of like, an embedded reporter for 18 months in the kitchen at a restaurant called Craigie on Main in Cambridge, close by to Boston. And you wrote a lot about the chef, Tony Maws, James Beard Award winner. But you have an interesting perspective. Would you mention to listeners what your day job is, Scott?
Sure. I'm happy to. My day job, I'm a clinical psychologist. I work consultatively in a number of state hospitals and also chiefly in communities, urban communities of color, so to speak. So I have a population that's really under a lot of distress, but that's my day job. And in addition to that, I won also a James Beard Award for my reporting on public radio a few years ago. So it's really a combination of things. On the one hand, I'm a trained clinical psychologist, a doctoral level. On the other hand, I spend a lot of time talking to chefs about food.
As a person who has a family member with a mental illness, I thank you for your efforts there. It's certainly very needed these days. But that does give you a unique perspective for writing about the chef, his staff, the customers, his parents, and all those people. And, you know, it's kind of a psychoanalysis of what's going on there.
Well, that's what it felt like to me. It was really, really exciting because as a clinical psychologist, you realize it's really not just about the food. I mean, when I interviewed a very famous French chef a few years ago, and he told me that one of his favorite dishes was this beautiful macaroni and cheese that his mother made. So he, 20 years later, went back and said, "Mom, can you please make it for me?" And he said it was so bad. It was just so awful. And he realized it wasn't that it was the mac and cheese that he craved. It was the love that his mother gave him when he was a little kid.
Mm.
And I think that happens to all of us in restaurants. I mean, I think the best restaurants, it's not just about the food. I mean, you can have a restaurant with beautiful food, but if the vibe in the restaurant or the feeling in the restaurant is one where it's cold and not inviting, you're probably not going to go back. And a lot of restaurants, I would say they get away with it, but they've emphasized front of the house. They emphasize service, so the guest feels honored. The guest feels like he or she is in that person's home. So I think the psychology of being in a restaurant for the customer is profound. And I think the psychology of working in a restaurant is also very challenging to work those hours and work those days.
You write a lot about the chef and his food and the business aspects of a restaurant. This guy, Tony Maws, that you worked closely with, what surprised you most about him after you got to really know him and work with him for a year and a half?
Chiefly, I've spent a lot of time in a lot of restaurants around the country, reporting for radio and reporting for magazines. And Tony, frankly, is very different than any other chef I've ever met in my whole life. He makes up things as he goes along. He doesn't have rules. When I describe what it is that he's cooking, nobody could answer that question for me. I said, "Tony, what are you cooking here?" And he said, "Well, it's French, farm to table, snout to nose." And I said, "Well, that really doesn't describe it." So we ended up calling his mom. I ended up calling his mother. And she really didn't have a terrific description of what it is that he's doing there. Most restaurants that I've worked in, particularly, say, in New York or Boston or California, there's a tradition. There's something that the chef relies upon, not just his or her instincts or his or her palate,
mm-hmm.
but some tradition, some rules, whether it's Italian or French or barbecue, whatever it is. There's some you do things a certain way. You don't add, chocolate syrup to the barbecue sauce because you think it's a good idea. You rely upon some well-founded rules that are decades old.
We're visiting on Food Talk STL with Scott Haas, who's written a book called Back of the House, The Secret Life of a Restaurant, about one specific restaurant in Boston. Although you do have comments in there from well-known chefs like Thomas Keller and Daniel Boulud and several others. An interesting observation you make, Scott, is you write that when a chef comes from a well-to-do family, that he's more likely to succeed than a chef who comes from a working-class upbringing. What's the deal there?
I didn't mean to imply that they necessarily do better, but they have less of a burden. I mean, there's a crushing debt that occurs to many people finishing culinary school, and unfortunately, some people, when they go to culinary school, are under the impression that they're going to be on Top Chef, they're going to be a chef owner of a restaurant, they're going to be independent, and frankly, that's just not always the case. In fact, it's not usually the case. So Tony had the great, great good fortune to grow up in an upper middle class family. He graduated, didn't have debt. His mom actually did a lot of the marketing and the management of the restaurant for many years. His father helped design the restaurant in terms of the electrical wiring and so on. So he emerged without those burdens. And in addition, when you think about it, his restaurant is unbelievably expensive. I mean, you're talking like $200 a dinner, $350, $400 a dinner for tasting menus.
Wow.
There's a contrast between a guy who grew up in a working-class neighborhood cooking for folks, dropping that kind of money, and a guy who's actually familiar with that kind of money, having grown up with it. It's almost like, you know, he's cooking, it's like clubhouse food, I think of it. I mean, he takes these chances with the food, but actually the customers, many of his customers, they went to the same types of schools he went to. They lived in the same kind of neighborhoods he grew up in. So it's not really a stretch for him. There's not this kind of socioeconomic burden that occurs for folks who suddenly find themselves in these very, very high-end restaurants, not having had that kind of firsthand experience with their customers.
Well, working in a restaurant, and you actually did, as well as sitting there taking notes, you actually worked on the line in the kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
Did your thoughts about the actual food change a lot over the year and a half you were there?
Well, I have to say, he taught me a lot about the way you handle ingredients. I mean to say that, you know, it wasn't just, say, making a burger and toasting the roll and having some ketchup and some relish with it. Every detail that went into the food was very important to him, and I changed the way I cook at home. So, for example, he used a pressure cooker, so I bought a pressure cooker, and it's changed the way I cook. I've started to do things from scratch. I'm not doing stuff like smoking meats or curing meats, but I pay a lot more attention to what I'm doing. He was very, very technique-driven, and I found that fascinating. And the food, the food that you eat in a restaurant, quite frankly, is probably not the food you should be eating at home. I mean to say, a well-known chef once said to me, the difference between a three-star restaurant and a four-star restaurant is a box of salt. So, there was a lot of salt and a lot of butter in his food, which is not unusual. It's fairly typical. I have never cooked that way, and having worked in the restaurant, I paid more attention to the amount of salt that I was using, ironically, or paid more attention to the amount of butter I was using. I ended up using less of it. So he made me think more about the food, essentially.
We're visiting on Food Talk STL on 590 The Fan, KFNS, with Scott Haas. He has a new book out. It's called Back of the House, The Secret Life of a Restaurant. And he took notes and actually worked in the kitchen of a restaurant called Craigie on Main in Cambridge, in the Boston area. And one of the things in the book, you know, you write a lot about the kitchen staff. You walk into the kitchen, I think, late on a Friday night. You and your wife have been out and gone to a new movie. And the people there, they seem, I guess, a little envious of your freedom. And you write about the sacrifice that people make to work in the kitchen of a fine restaurant.
It's pretty brutal, frankly. I mean, you're talking about kids, a lot of kids in their 20s, who are working 16, 17-hour days, you know, 5 or 6 days a week. One of the guys said to me, one of the sous chefs said to me, I said, why do you do it, Matt? This guy named Matt Foley, a wonderful guy. And he said, well, look, here's the thing. I don't get my clothes to the dry cleaner on time. I don't make my rent on time. He said, I can't deal with the normal things. What I can deal with is getting, you know, the food to the table on time. I like mm-hmm. the rhythm of the kitchen. So on the one hand, it's a sacrifice, but on the other hand, it's a home for a lot of people. Restaurants historically have been a place where people who, say, didn't fit into a 9-to-5 or didn't want a 9-to-5 or couldn't deal with relationships the way the restaurants try to deal with them, they found a home in restaurants. So I think that the sacrifice has its benefits. You really can, in some ways, avoid some of the challenges that come with intimacy.
Now, the guy that you write about in your book, Back of the House, Tony Maws, chef owner, just wants one restaurant. Now, there's so many people in St. Louis, Scott, who open a restaurant, they're successful, And a year or two or three later, when their cash flow in is pretty good, they start talking to real estate people about the second and maybe even the third location. You think your guy will ever open another place there in Boston?
Well, I hope so. I mean, I think he's talking. There's rumors of a second place. I mean, I commend chefs for opening more restaurants. I look at it from the point of view of the guy who designed your Volkswagen or the guy who designed your shirt isn't the guy actually making the car or making the shirt. It's really about management. It's really about building teams. So I think it's the mark of a mature chef to be able to open more than one restaurant. You know, back in the day when I was a kid, my folks would take me to restaurants, and yeah, there was one family that owned one restaurant, but I don't think that's necessary anymore.
There's a lot of stuff in your book, Scott, about who's going to make it as a chef and who's not, and I'll read an excerpt here. I think this is great. I highlighted it with my Sharpie, and it says, running a restaurant starts with knowing how to cook. But the essence of the job, the skill that separates the best chefs from everyone else, is managing people. And then you have a nice long list of all the people that a chef has to manage. The purveyors, the people you get the food from, the cooks, the floor staff, the city health inspectors, oh yeah, immigration officers, electricians, plumbers, investors, the media, and of course, your restaurant guests. And it's a lot of balls to keep in the air.
Well, the number one, that, by the way, that list is inspired by my wife, who said, any job, the number one thing that has, if you're working with people, it's management of people. My wife is a family doctor at Boston Medical Center, and she works with teams, and she's really educated me about how teams create the situation. I mean, that it's not just the doctor, but it's also the nurses, the receptionists, everyone is a fundamental part of the team. And the other, I mean, I guess the main thing that I think of with the great chefs that I know is that they don't take things personally. It's not about them. It's about the restaurant. It's about the customer. It's about creating a memorable experience. Thomas Keller said to me once, I said, what are you doing here? Why do you spend so much time here in this restaurant? And he said to me, I'm trying to create memories. And he said that to me like 15, 20 years ago, and it really has a lasting impact that there's so many experiences we go through in life, no matter what it is, that we don't remember. And a restaurant, the very, very, very best restaurants are the ones that create the best memories. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't have to be high-end. There's a great hot dog place in South Boston called Sullivan's, and I'm telling you, it's the best dogs in New England. Because the staff is wonderful, the dogs are good, the customers are having fun. It's really creating memories. And I think that when a chef personalizes everything, it distracts from what's on the table and who you're with.
Well, I like your book in that it's one that a restaurant insider, somebody who works in a kitchen or works on the front of the house, can read and enjoy, and people who enjoy going to restaurants. But I think also looking at it from the business point of view, because there's a lot to look at from the business aspect as well. So you cover mm-hmm. a lot of bases there, man.
I'm trying, Lord knows. I mean, the thing about restaurants that the best chefs also realize, this is something else the best chefs realize, it's you're running a business, you know. So if you come into, how many businesses do you know, whether it's a car dealership or a drugstore, you can't yell at your employees and expect them to be motivated. There's going to be high turnover. There's going to be a lot of resentment. There's going to be theft. But if you treat your employees with love and respect and you pay them a fair wage and you listen to them when they complain and set limits and are punitive when they do things wrong, you're going to run a good business. The chef who runs a restaurant like some kind of an ego trip, that's old school. That doesn't last anymore.
We're visiting with Scott Haas from Boston. His book is called Back of the House, The Secret Life of a Restaurant. About a year and a half he spent in the kitchen at Craigie-on-Main in Cambridge. Congratulations on your book. It's due out on Tuesday, February 5th. List is $16. It's a trade paperback, although I saw it on Amazon, Scott.
I was going to say, go for Amazon. Go to Amazon, right.
1088.
Exactly it.
And it's on Kindle, and I guess every other probably Nook and iTunes as well, right?
Absolutely.
Hey, thank you very much for your time. Good luck with your book.
No, thank you.
It's an entertaining book. I know you've been doing a lot of publicity. I read your blog. And do you want to mention your blog for people?
Sure. My blog is called Shrink in the Kitchen, and it's meant to be a sort of entertaining blog site that looks for contexts for food, because I think food without meaning, without context, doesn't mean as much as when you provide some kind of a surrounding for it.
Well, you've certainly done that with your book. It's called Back of the House, The Secret Life of a Restaurant by Scott Haas. Thanks, man. Enjoy the
chat.
Thank
you so much, David.
Scott Haas on Food Talk 590, on Food Talk STL, on 590 The Fan, KFNS. I'm David Craig. We're broadcasting from the Bomarito Automotive Group Studios here at 590, and we have more Food Talk coming up here in just a few minutes.